The Canby Report was produced and recorded on the traditional and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem peoples.
It's April 8th, 2022, and there are 190 days left until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Canby Report.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Matthew Naylor.
Welcome back.
Yeah, what a Easter basket full of tasty Easter eggs we have for you today, including one giant Easter egg, which is too massive. It's one of those big chocolate bunnies that we are unable to eat in one sitting, and so we are actually going to be deferring it into a deep dive where we can get the chocolate all over our faces, and that, of course, is the Vancouver plan.
But like eating too much chocolate, we'll probably feel really bad about it after, and nothing actually good will come from it.
Dark. Chocolate.
I'm pessimistic about this city. Lots of other stuff is happening. Why don't we just jump right into it? But before we do that, we need your support, dear listeners. We put out a couple episodes in the last couple weeks on the candidates running for, well, who were acclaimed for the Green Party's nomination, the candidates who are seeking nominations from COPE this weekend. I'm getting great feedback from those episodes. If you like those, we need your support to keep doing them. Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Yes, Patreon.com/CanbyReport. Your source for citizen journalism in Metro Vancouver.
Patreon.com/CanbyReport. Let's jump in very briefly to the Vancouver plan. 150-page draft document has finally come forward looking at the future of the city by 2050. How are we going to fit 260,000 more people in the city?
Well, multiplexes is the answer.
It turns out Hector Bremner was right all along.
So, our ambitions do not reach as high as a million people. They apparently extend to 260,000 more people, up, bringing us up to 920,000 people and 210,000 more jobs by 2050. Big ideas in there, equitable housing and complete neighborhoods, an economy that works for all, and climate protection and restored ecosystems.
All of these are viewed through the lenses of reconciliation, equity, and resilience. This is, like I said, it's a 150-page document. The thing I think we're both most interested in is the land use map, and we'll dig into that deeply next week. It digs into a lot of other things, things like putting industrial lands and expanding them along the Fraser. There is a really cool map in there on ecological corridors that they could open up through the city. This is like daylighting streams and letting, I don't know, bears and coyotes roam through the city once more.
Urban cougars. It's going to be great.
Lots of stuff on transportation. A cool map of like how to make sure there's arts and cultural centers within walkable distances of most neighborhoods, except Shaughnessy, because you just have pianos in your great rooms in your mansions.
Yeah, we can't go back to the rooming house era. It would be terrible.
And food, watersheds, tons of stuff. Any high-level takeaways before we just move on to everything else that's happening?
It is impressive in its completeness. Like, I think that I was a little worried that something unambitious and a little, like, half-baked would come out of this process, but it is a fully-fledged city plan that does look like it could actually be a roadmap forward for densification and for growth in the city, especially with, like, this new municipal town center, like, centered around Oak Ridge that I think has some strong potential.
Yeah, the big challenge with this document is that it's like the plan to create a plan if council comes on board. It will require the city to adopt an official development plan. It will require a lot of different bylaws to change. The land use plan explicitly notes in the corner of it that this is not. So yeah, it's a plan to create a plan that requires council to get off their butts and commit to a vision.
Whether this is actually possible is anyone's guess. My guess is that they won't.
And we have an election to fight over this, so cool.
Yeah.
It needs a champion.
Yeah, and if anyone, it might end up being Ken Sim, because this, like, it seems
almost more like the kind of plan that he would come up with.
Either that or possibly Adrian Carr. Like, if the Green Party actually, like, really decides that this milquetoast multiplex plan is... It's not all milquetoast, but, like, it doesn't go as far to identify the city as I perhaps would have liked. The Green Party might actually be the key constituency for it.
One of the challenges this plan is inevitably going to face, though, is this NIMBY, frankly, fear that is ever present in this in the city of Vancouver of anything taller than, I don't know, a three-story house. Even then, sometimes those are a little bit ominous. And I bring this up because there is a new op-ed in the Taii and a shadowy group called the Jericho Coalition that have come together to say that Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh Nation-led ambitious development on the Jericho lands to build out massive development of towers and communities there, it needs a human-scaled rethink.
Yeah, which apparently includes the magic from Dungeons & Dragons' Bag of Holding, because they want to take the towers that are there, which have a certain number of units in them, downscale the development, make shorter buildings, save the exact same amount of green space, not increase the footprint area, and have the same number of units and the same number of floor space, which to me sounds impossible. But that's just me with my math.
People might just be living underground. My other favorite part of the series of renditions that they've put on this article and on their website about how ominous these towers look is that it doesn't show, and others have pointed this out, especially in our Slack, is it doesn't show any hills. Like, these towers are not at the same geographic altitude as the houses across, I think that's 4th Ave. They are quite down a hill. So the sight lines are not blocked anywhere near as much as these various pictures would have you believe. This is a steep part of Vancouver, and it actually can make sense to have taller buildings at the bottom of this. Meanwhile, I'm seeing people being like, oh, this is going to ruin the beach. And it's like, well, their plan would have as many people, in theory, living there. And if people ruin a beach, then it will be just as ruined. But I think the hint here is if they can get the towers to be shorter, they can eventually just get fewer people in there and just save the mansion district. And I keep calling it a mansion district, even though a lot of these aren't the biggest houses. But at this point, they're all worth $3 million plus, I want to guess.
Yeah, it's a mansion district. If you have a single detached house in the city, you have effectively a mansion. It may not be like Shaughnessy sized, but you have a value of a mansion at the very least.
The other thing that gets me in here is Condon and Scott Hine is the co-author on this piece, draw an analogy to the Arbutus Walk neighborhood. And I actually lived in that neighborhood, and it's a beautiful, lovely place to live. But the condos there are not cheap. The condo I lived in, my in-laws sold it for over $1 million for a two-bed, two-bath, 800 square feet place. Like, if your concern is luxury condos, your low-rises are going to be just as expensive, if not more, than your high-rises in this kind of area.
I have some very fond memories of that first Canby Report studio.
To almost every mayoral candidate in that spare bedroom.
In addition to towers that will doom the area to a terrible fate, the Jericho development will also be inclusive of a SkyTrain station.
Yeah, City Council just approved endorsing a change to the proposal to extend the Millennium Line from Arbutus, where it's currently scheduled to terminate, to UBC. So instead of going up to Sassamat, it will go down to this Jericho area, which would be fantastic. I mean, the other thing I forgot to mention on Condon and Hine's piece, and I should mention that Bill Thielman, it turns out, is really pushing this Jericho coalition nonsense as well, is what really gets me is how much in the article and in their propaganda they're downplaying the Indigenous involvement in this project. Condon and Hine call it like a partnership between the nations and the city of Vancouver, but that the city of Vancouver should really put its foot down. It really just undermines the idea of reconciliation and letting, like, technically the land is owned by the Canada Land Corporation, but if we're going to start every meeting with this is unceded Coast Salish territory, we should let the Coast Salish nations do with what they want on their lands when they run it.
Yeah. It's not a question for us to be micromanaging their developments. That is part of what reconciliation means. And some of reconciliation will be difficult because it means giving up white supremacy, basically.
Or you can just reassert it and tell them what they should do with the land and have colonial governments stomp on them. Speaking of stomping on people of color,
our editorial position is we should not do that, incidentally.
But. Yes. The Vancouver police budget is coming to council. As we mentioned, I think on our last episode, the province denied the city's decision to reduce their budget by a few million dollars in 2021, and now council must decide how to pay for that. Staff have come forward with a report that said you can either pull it from reserves or you can vote for a tax increase. But to do a tax increase means you have to undo a previous vote, so it'll require a two-thirds majority to push through that tax increase. So I don't think that's happening.
No, I do not either, especially since so many of the candidates are running on affordability. Like, the big question is whether the coalition in favor of the police and the coalition in favor of keeping taxes low, whether they will be able to pull individual members, like which way is Lisa DeGenova going to vote, which way is Rebecca Bly going to vote. The ex-NPA and NPA people have typically been the most supportive of keeping taxes low, but also the most supportive of the police. So it is an open question as to whether or not this funding, which is apparently mandatory, is possible to appropriate.
Yeah, there's a second motion in here in the council members' motion. Jean Swanson wants the city to reject the increased police budget. And by reject, she means to say they disagree and write a letter to Minister Farnworth saying they disagree. There's not really much else they can do. I have heard a rumor that people in the city are looking at legal options. As we discussed last time, there is that. There's always, you can always sue. It doesn't always go anywhere,
yes,
but you can always sue people in this country. I'm curious to see if they'll strengthen it.
Alphas and deficits of our legal system is you can sue anyone for almost any reason at almost any time.
Until you get labeled, what is it?
Vexatious litigant.
Yeah. I would love to see a city get labeled a vexatious litigant, but I'll be watching that police budget debate. Quite interesting.
Yes. So, there is a proposal for a mansion tax.
Yeah, Jean Swanson's also bringing forward a motion, finally, to urge the province to amend the charter to allow differential property taxes based on the value of the property and to see how much that could help end homelessness, in her wording, and to report back. The idea here would be that you scale property taxes with the value of the property in the same way that we scale income taxes with the amount of income you make. There is a little bit of progressiveness in property taxes now since the province introduced its school tax surcharge, but that doesn't go to the cities. It doesn't even go to the schools. It goes to the provincial coffers. And I think this is a pretty good motion for Swan. Like, this is something she's talked about a lot, and I'm actually surprised she hadn't brought this motion sooner.
Yeah, it does seem like it's right up her alley. I am not opposed to this kind of thing. It seems actually pretty sensible. The federal government, and this is something that we might actually delve into in our show next week, because it delves into housing. The federal government just released a budget that has many billions of dollars for housing affordability. And some of the reactions to this budget have been that there needs to be a tax on the wealth accumulated in possibly the top 10% of homes. That wealth accumulation is massive and untaxed. So looking at some of the value captured in that at a municipal level is a good idea.
Yeah, and one of the things we didn't even get into it, but that's in the Vancouver plan are concerns about funding. And so finding more ways to pay for that change will be necessary. One thing that could actually cost the city a lot, though, is an Olympic bid. So maybe we should just have a referendum on it.
Yes, moving to the other end of council's political spectrum, Colleen Hardwick is proposing a Olympic bid on the 2030 Olympics vote, for which all the scuttlebutt that I have been reading online suggests that Vancouver is actually the front runner for this Olympics, now that it is an Indigenous-led bid. So it is a reasonable thing to look at whether or not we want the bid. Do I actually think a referendum is necessary? No, never. Never do I think a referendum is necessary. I think representative government is perfectly acceptable to make these kind of calls. But Colleen Hardwick is proposing a vote. Whether she'll get a seconder, however, is anyone's guess.
Yeah, I wasn't able to dig it all up, but I remember when she was first talking about this idea of a plebiscite, you had people like the mayor, even Sarah Kirby-Young, talking about, and a number of other councillors talking about how they did not agree. And they say, look, this is being led by the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. It's not the city's job to come in and say no then. If they want to lead it, that's great. You know, when we talked to Mayor Kennedy Stewart, that was his position, even in December. And so, like, I think Melissa DeGenova even put forward a pro-Olympic 2030 motion. So I really do wonder if anyone is going to second her motion, and this may just die on the floor before even being debated, which would be hilarious.
Everyone needs a little bit of levity at council. Now, Ian... other news, and speaking of Melissa DeGenova, Councillor DeGenova wants free Chinatown parking on Sundays. Chinatown is dying.
Yeah, she's got a motion coming forward on Tuesday as well, highlighting the challenges Chinatown is facing, both from the pandemic as well as a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, which is something I think every councillor is united in tackling. What's weird in this motion is that it tries to say we should do 3 hours of free parking at meters and at city-owned lots on Sundays and use that as a pilot to figure out if it's worthwhile. I think we've both spoken against free parking in general, and that maybe there are better ways the city could support. The other two half parts of this motion are to work with the VPD to try to tackle violent crime, vandalism, property theft, and graffiti, and to look at ways the city can deal with anti-Asian hate crimes in general.
Yeah, and while those are all laudable goals, it's the free parking thing that kind of gives me a bit of pause. Why cannot there be other incentives, like creating a festival or something or other to bring people into the district? But that is what it is, and Melissa will be advocating for it at the coming council meeting, and we will give you an update on that as things progress.
Changing to the upcoming election news, we have a few announcements that have come out. I think the most notable is Team Kennedy Stewart has launched their official brand after running undoubtedly the most thorough and detailed focus groups to find the most positive name they could come up with. They came up with Forward Together Vancouver.
Yeah, it means less than nothing. Admittedly, most of things mean less than nothing when it comes to Vancouver party names, but I don't know, Forward Together, sure, why not? Great.
He's promising to run a number of candidates on his slate, so we'll keep our eye on that. Two candidates who I'm pretty confident won't be on his slate, even though they had equally slick campaign videos announcing their re-election bids, are Rebecca Bly and Lisa Dominato. And I think what was most interesting about both of their announcements, which came one day after the other, is a lot of people noted that their videos looked almost the same.
Yes, they do. They look very, very, very similar, almost as if they are done by the same outfit.
They have not said who they're going to run with yet. The speculation is still potentially Ken Sims' party, but maybe they'll form their own less than nonpartisan slate.
Yeah. A non-nonpartisan association, nonpartisan association slate.
An even less partisan slate.
So, the Ministry of Solicitor of Public Safety and Solicitor General and responsible for local government has announced changes to the law so that those charged with crimes must take a leave of absence, a paid leave of absence, from counsel.
It's funny because we don't know exactly who triggered this law. There was the Rob Vagramov sexual charges cases. The Doug McCallum is currently facing charges and refuses to step down. It's debated actually whether this will apply to McCallum because his mischief charges might not rise high enough to trigger this. And so there's,
I mean, 100% it won't apply to McCallum because it won't be able to be applied retroactively. But in the future, if you are charged with a crime, you will be placed on administrative leave, paid administrative leave, and asked to step aside. If you are convicted, you will be automatically removed from counsel.
But it's quite notable that this was even necessary, as debate arose in Port Moody initially when Vagramov was charged several years ago. Those charges were later stayed following out-of-court dispute resolution set.
Yeah.
Alternative measures.
He went to alternative measures. Yeah.
And as we mentioned, in Surrey, the mayor just like refuses to step down despite mischief charges based on allegations of how he treated political rivals, which is something that happened.
Yeah, it almost is too ridiculous to be believed. But there it is, our city of Surrey.
Meanwhile, over in Burnaby, a councillor and MLA, actually the finance minister, got into a bit of a spat over the fact that the new candidate for the Vancouver Kilchenna by-election is one Dr. Jeanette Ash, Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart's wife, and quite well qualified in her own right as a political scientist, it's worth saying. But what got newly elected Burnaby councillor Martin Kendall, an independent, in trouble was his tweet: other than being Kennedy Stewart's wife, what are her qualifications?
Yes, Selena Robinson then retweeted this, quoting it, saying, "Misogyny at its finest, hashtag BC Poly." And in fairness to Selena Robinson, yeah, it's pretty misogynistic. Martin Kendall should not have said that.
He did delete the tweet. He did apologize to anyone who saw it in that context, which he also understands, and it wasn't his intent. He blames his bad mental place due to the antics and tantrums of his 4-year-old daughter, which I kind of actually get. I get having a bad toddler frustrating you and then you go on Twitter and shitpost. Like, I've been there. I haven't been misogynistic because of it, but...
So, Dr. Jeanette Ash has decided to go and lose the Vancouver Kilchenna by-election because it's Vancouver Kilchenna and the most BC liberal-leaning riding in the province, by some metrics.
Well, sometimes within Metro Van, right? It's not Peace River North.
No, yeah, fair enough. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's like West Van Capilano, sometimes it's Vancouver Kilchenna, but like it's a very BC liberal-leaning riding.
Let's go to the North Shore.
Yes, North Shore wastewater development news. Konia has been fired, and they are now suing the Metro Vancouver Authority for, I guess, being angry that Oconia abandoned their projects. They're seeking $250 million in damages and unpaid bills for wrongful and unnecessary termination. Metrovan is confidently and stridently defending themselves, saying, absolutely not, you abandoned the project, what the fuck?
The company is claiming there were 1,000+ modifications made to the project, resulting in delays and cost increases that were outside its scope. It's basically blaming the Metro for making it impossible to complete. Yeah. Constructive dismissal, but then they actually got dismissed. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this goes forward. The fact they've sued now means there will be a process of discovery, so we're going to learn a lot more about this project. Or at least someone will, if they pay the $6 to get all the court documents.
We'll probably pay the $6. So at the time, the project was only 36% complete. And long past the original 2020 completion date, there was an agreed to fixed price and fixed date contracts. And despite revisions to the agreed timeline, they still failed to meet key construction milestones. They asked for a further increase in budget, which would almost double the original contract price. Metro Vancouver states that it is confident that its decision to terminate was justified. They have now hired PCL Constructors West Coast Incorporated and the designer AECOM to take over the project.
I'm now actually going to turn it over, I forgot to warn you about this, Matthew, to an interview I did with Councillor Christine Boyle and MLA Bowen Ma about their new podcast, People's Pod. We'll listen to that. You can listen to the other half of that interview on Politicoast, actually. Welcome to Canby Report, Christine Boyle, Councillor with the City of Vancouver, and Bowen Ma, MLA in the province of BC.
Hello, thanks for having us.
We're picking up a conversation we started over on Politicoast about your new podcast, Politics for the People. We talked a lot about the show itself there. Maybe just give listeners the one, you know, the one sentence, the two sentence summary of the show if they didn't bother to listen to that. They should.
Absolutely. The goal of the podcast is to demystify government, to engage people who have never been involved before or who are on the edges of political engagement and those wanting to get more involved, and to provide what we hope is some useful insight for advocates and activists about making change inside and outside of the government system.
So in this part of our conversation, I want to talk a bit more. I pretty much want to steal content from your show, but get you to say it again in another format, because I think it'll be interesting to the listeners. Let's maybe start with just that big question of, like, why get involved in politics? Like, why did you personally get involved, and why do you think other people should?
Well, there was a long period of time in my life when I was not politically active, not politically literate, and it just seemed like something that was too much work for me to keep up on, given, you know, everything else that was going on in my life. Taking care of family and friends and building your career, like everything going on in what we, I guess, the electoral political sphere just seemed so divorced from my life. But the reality is that whether or not we think that we are interested in politics or not, the reality is that politics is very much interested in us. It impacts us on a day-to-day basis. It impacts our families, our communities. It impacts our province. It impacts our children's futures. And so once you see those connections, it's very difficult to not care. And once you care, you want to know, how do I make things better?
Yeah, I have been politically involved since I was a teenager. And I always had a sense that elections mattered, but it wasn't the sphere that I was involved in. And to some degree, I sort of felt like my community activism was more important. That the more work I did in the community, the more and more it became clear to me just how much of an impact who was in government had for the types of work that we could do at the community level. And so that's what got me more engaged in politics, volunteering on the campaigns of people I was excited about or who I knew had a commitment to the issues that I cared about, because I saw at the very ground level what that meant for what we could be doing, how we could be supporting people in the front lines of community and activism.
So we're recording this on March 11th, and it'll come out later this month. We have to figure that out still. But listeners will be listening to this in the kind of pre-election season here in Metro Vancouver, as things start to heat up for the municipal elections. I know you, for example, Christine, were just renominated by the members of One City to run for council again, along with a number of very talented individuals. So I'm kind of curious what both of you would suggest for those who are considering or have already put their name forward to council. Like, what advice do you have for these people who are excited to try to win the hearts and minds of their fellow citizens?
Oh, I think they should listen to our podcast and get them a rundown on everything that they need.
You know, we talk a lot about how politics is a team sport. And I think that's important, whether you are in a municipality like Vancouver, where there are parties, or running in a place where there isn't a party system. So important to have a team, to pull together a team of volunteers, engaged community members. Maybe it's a team of other electeds that you're running with, but the work is only accomplished as a team. And so the campaign, I think, really needs to mirror that. As you know, because we're talking about our 6-hour podcast, we have many, many hours of advice. But that is some of what it comes down to. I think for both of us, it's a team. It's really important to stay grounded in the reasons that you're doing that work, the reason you want to run for office. Elections can be kind of destabilizing, especially if it's your first time. There's so much being thrown in every direction. It's really hard to stay focused, and it's really important to stay focused. And so we talk about that a fair amount too, kind of keeping your feet on the ground and your head on and your heart on why this matters to you and your community.
Would you say it's worth it? Like in your podcast, in some of the episodes, I've only listened to the first couple. There are challenges, right? You talk, Christine, about the challenge of balancing your family life, and both of you have experienced, I'm sure, undoubted amounts of online harassment. Even just, you talked about in your podcast, just always having to be on, like people recognizing you in the street and wanting to talk politics, even when you're like, I just want to get my kid's haircut.
We are very candid about the challenges that people may face if they come into this work. We're not looking to paint everything as rainbows and kitty cats in this and glamour and style and all that. I think the real purpose, or one of the major purposes of our podcast, is to be honest about the stuff that sucks about being in government, quite frankly, and the stuff that sucks about being a politician. And yet help people understand that if you're passionate about making social change, this is still one of the most powerful ways that you can be involved in that. And so I don't know if I've given a good answer.
Yeah, well, and we both, like Bowen said, we want to be honest about it. And absolutely, we think that it's a huge honor and responsibility to be doing this work. And, you know, I think often, particularly at city budget time, but around many key decisions that we make, what a huge honor and responsibility it is to be at that table and to be having a say in, you know, millions of dollars of community funding that I know from decades of community work makes an enormous difference at that level. And so I get to be in regular touch with folks doing that most on the ground work. And then I get to be at the decision-making table to make sure as best as possible at the local level, their important work is resourced adequately for the huge demands that we're facing. So unquestionably, I think it's worth it. You know, I can get called a witch as many times as you want on Twitter, and it's not going to scare me away from recognizing the huge importance of this work and taking it so seriously because of that, which is maybe why we're both so honest about how draining and demanding it is. That's balanced with just the responsibility that we feel for doing it well.
I'd say that we believe that it is empowering for people who are looking to enter into this kind of work to know ahead of time the kind of challenges that they may face so that they can be prepared for it, because it is important work. And if it was easy, then just anybody would do it and it maybe wouldn't be all that important. It's difficult for a reason. And we need people who are courageous and willing to recognize the importance of this work while still also being willing to I guess, do some of that self-sacrificing that it takes to do this well.
One of the things I'm really excited to listen to and hear you talk about is that this isn't just a podcast for candidates and elected officials to kind of think about politics from that point of view. You talk in our other conversation about how the structure you have for it kind of ends with the discussion about getting involved in electoralism, but a lot of it is those other elements to politics. Maybe you could talk a bit about, you know, what do you discuss, for example, for all of those people, which is the most, you know, the vast majority who aren't going to run for office but still want to make a difference politically.
Sure. So episodes 3 and 4 are my favorite. They're sort of a pair. They talk about making change from the inside and then making change from the outside. And one of the things I've been really conscious of in my 3.5 years at local government is what I'm learning from inside government that I didn't know when I was trying to advocate from outside the system that I think is really useful. So I, any chance I get, meet with community groups to help them better understand what's happening internally and how they can best have an impact, whether it's budget decisions or it's policy decisions, because the system is better off when more of those voices are involved. And so we have a whole episode, but then threads woven throughout the whole series about that, about what we're learning in terms of the type of kind of inside-outside engagement that helps move important issues forward.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my life not even knowing who my MLA or MP was, let alone engaging with them. And so I'm keenly aware of the fact that there's a huge segment of the population that doesn't even know that they can reach out to me as their MLA and request a meeting and email me and actually get responses and talk to me on the street. So even at that level, we're trying to kind of break some of the opaqueness of engaging with your elected official.
And I guess that kind of brings it back to the goals of the podcast. I didn't ask you about this in the last section. You kind of talk about demystifying politics, but what is it that you would hope an audience will come out of listening to the whole series? Like, how will a listener be different at the end than at the start?
Well, we hope to enable greater civic engagement, to help advocacy groups be more effective in their work, and for those who might be interested in running to gain the confidence of knowing what's coming for them if they do make that leap. And finally, just to allow regular residents of British Columbia or Vancouver or anywhere, I mean, it could be other provinces or across the country, to be more confident about reaching out and engaging with their MLA, their MP, their city councillor on day-to-day issues that matter to them.
Yeah, people seeing that they have a place in this system that affects them, that they should be able to affect it too, and to have a better sense of how they might be able to do that well.
Great. Well, I guess my last question will just be then, are you looking forward to the upcoming municipal elections?
Ooh, of course. Democracy, yes. You know,
democracy, yes, is a good position for an elected official to take.
I'm still in the job. And so I guess my caution in answering that is just that, as Canby Report listeners are well aware, this election started very early. And I'm still focused on doing the work you all elected me to do in 2018. So I have some caution about launching into elections and campaigns too soon and neglecting the work that still very much matters for people's lives. So both of those, absolutely. And I'm excited about the One City candidates that I get to run alongside. And I'm still in it at the table doing the work that's still my focus, my main job. But democracy, yay! Absolutely.
Finally, where can people find the podcast when they want to start listening to it?
Great question. You can find the podcast on Buzzsprout and all of the other places that you get podcasts, as well as on our website, peoplespod.ca. You can find both Bowen and I on all or many of the social media channels.
Social media channels.
Yep.
You're even on TikTok, right, Bowen?
I am. I am on TikTok.
She's so hip. And our sixth episode is Ask Me Anything episode. And so we're really hoping people will send us questions and we'll spend the whole episode trying to answer them. And people can send us questions at questions@peoplespod.ca.
Yeah, questions@peoplespod.ca.
Great. Thank you both for your time this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So give that podcast a listen. It sounds like a fascinating look into the internal side for an outsider inside politics.
Nailed it.
Yep. And with that stunning double backflip landing into a absolutely shattered ankle, let's move on to our Vancouverada.
I was thinking, since it's spring, since the leaves are turning, my flowers are starting to come out in the garden that I can have in my suburban single-family home, we could talk about the cherry blossoms that are making our streets so pretty these days and look back. Our information here is coming from a 2013 Vancouver Sun article written by Steve Weissel, How Vancouver Got to Be Cherry Blossom Heaven. The story dates back to the 1930s when Japanese cities of Kobe and Yokohama gave the park board 500 trees to plant at the Japanese cenotaph in Stanley Park, honoring Japanese Canadians who served in the First World War. Oh, they were. I'm just thinking about the history and how quickly the city turned against them after that.
Yeah, though in fairness, they did invade Manchuria and bomb Pearl Harbor, so.
The Japanese Canadians didn't.
No, true enough. But the Japanese cities of Kobe and Yokohama were, you know, still part of Imperial Japan at the time.
In 1958, yeah, another 300 trees were donated by the Japanese consul.
In succession to this, the park board got a little carried away and ended up planting what could arguably call too many cherry trees, bringing the number up to 17,000.
Now that's around a third of the trees in the city. 36% in the 90s were cherry blossoms or ornamental plums. There's another 13,000 ornamental plums at the time of this writing. So 2 in 5
that's
trees.
A lot of
1 in 3. That is a lot. It makes the city very pink, except on those rainy springs when, well, it's still pink, but it's the gutters that are pink rather than the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you, Kobe and Yokohama.
Yes, and park boards of years past for giving us this marvelous season in our beautiful city. That is all for the Cami Report this week. We are going to be back next week with a deep dive into both the municipal plan, the Vancouver City Plan, and a look at the municipal implications of the federal budget. Till then, I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
You have yourselves a great day, listeners.
Chippy's in his mansion, counting up his wealth again. We're on the pavement, mad at the 1% man in the big house, mortgage paid off. While we nurse a bad cough, COVID, and we're laid off. Tax the rich and homelessness. God knows when. They won't hoard and choose to spend. You better peep down the alleyway. You'll see an unhoused man. A man running Lulu made $1 million in the last year. Could house all the neighbors if he chose to pay his fair share. Over 2,000 homeless, 300k to house one, over 600 mil to get the folks housing done. Mansion tax is bringing in 25 mil a year, so we can house a homeless neighbors in only 3 years. Tax the rich to end homelessness. Walk down Plague Gray Road, see the massive mansion row. Go to East Hastings, where the money should go. If you love your neighbor, you'll fight for him too. Unlike billionaires, they might fight for you. Rich and homelessness. God knows when. They won't hoard and choose to spend. You better peep down the alleyway. You'll see an unhoused man. Man running Lulu made $1 billion in the last year. Can house all the neighbors if he chose to pay his fair share.